The financial nightmare we've all been dreading is closer to becoming a reality. One of the world's biggest banks says there will be a recession next year. And if you think that gives you plenty of time to prepare, think again. There are some crucial things you should be doing, and you should start doing them right now. We've got the list. Plus, inside the gates, it's the happiest place on earth. But what's happening on the other side of the fence? Walt Disney World makes a huge announcement, and it could mean big changes for employees who've been living in squalor. And then, just as Tiger Woods gets ready for the Masters, Mr. and Mrs. Thacker are making headlines too. It seems the golf club's been buying up every home around the course except for theirs. They won't budge, not even for millions. Also tonight, money is not usually a problem for these two, daughters of Vladimir Putin. But thanks to President Biden, it's about to be a big problem because Daddy's war in Ukraine just curtailed their every move. And while no two wars are exactly the same, they are not always all that different.
Shoot that motherfucker! Shoot that motherfucker!
See all those people standing down there? Light them all up.
Come on, fire!
Can the U.S. war in Afghanistan take us inside the mind of warriors in Ukraine? Find out tonight on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield. It has been whispered, it has been rumored, but now they're just flat out saying it. Recession. It's the dirty word describing a country's economy when it has negative growth for at least two quarters. That's 8 months. We know it when we hear it, and today we heard it. One of the world's biggest banks, Deutsche Bank, confidently announced there is one on the way. With rising interest rates, they say a U.S. recession will likely begin late next year as the country grapples with some of the fastest growing inflation in decades. Deutsche is predicting a mild recession, but come on, let's be frank. There is nothing good that comes of even a mild recession. It's a period where the economy struggles and companies make fewer sales and people lose their jobs and investments go south. And that really stinks if you need those investments now or in the next 5 to 10 years. Remember 2 years ago, we had a bad recession when the pandemic took hold. And then remember back in 2008, that was a whopper when the housing market collapsed. Recession is a word that sends shivers down the spines of financial forecasters and hardworking Americans, which is why it is not usually tossed around lightly. And if you're thinking, Ashley, I got plenty of time, why worry? Snap out of it. Even the economics team at Goldman Sachs is projecting a, quote, significant chance the economy will fall into a recession sometime in the next 12 months, they say. Ask any American and they've already seen the writing on the wall. A recent survey found 81% of us think that the U.S. will experience a recession this year. But there are things that you can do right now to gear up, bear down, and protect your families, your homes, and most importantly, your investments. I'm joined by Matt Sapala. He's America's money smart guy, a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. His new mission is teaching people how to take charge of their personal finances and realize financial independence. And Catherine Tuggle's with me as well. She is the chief content officer of HerMoney.com and also the co-author of the book, How to Money. So these are the perfect two people to help me navigate what is coming down the pike. Okay, so Catherine, let me begin with you. You know, the natural course in things is correction or recession. It's not like we haven't been through it if you've been around the block once or twice. But what does that mean for people who actually might need their money sooner and don't have the time to build their money back up if a recession takes a hammer to it?
Right. I'm hoping that there's a little bit of muscle memory left from 2008 when so many of us who are still in the workforce went through this, perhaps for the first time. But, you know, we really learned that having cash on hand is the way to go, particularly if you're nearing retirement, because the worst thing, the last thing that you want to have to do is to draw down on your investments when the markets are down, thereby losing money. You know, this really couldn't be coming at a worse time, because a lot of people who had to deplete their emergency funds in 2020 just to survive, just to pay the bills, to keep a roof over their head, they haven't had time to build those emergency funds back up yet. So when I see that number in the headline that we could be headed for a recession in 2023, it is concerning given where many of Americans are right now with their financial picture.
I can sort of see people in their kitchen, you know, seeing the news come across their TV sets or their radios and then sort of stopping dead in their tracks thinking, oh, there's so many things I need to do and I don't even know where to start. But Matt, it's important for everybody watching right now to know they are not lambs to the slaughter unless they choose to be, right?
100%. You know, there's a conversation about playing financial defense and there's a conversation about playing financial offense. And I remember in 08, 09, I remember buying some real estate in 05, 06 and everything was just inflated. And next thing you know, home prices were less than what people owed on their mortgage. I clearly remember that. And I remember people tightening up. I remember people panicking. And I remember people saying, hey, you know, what am I going to do? My 401k turned into a 201k. But I think if we can learn from those bad mistakes, you know, we learn more from our bad mistakes with money than from our good experiences. And so what were some of those things? Some of those things were making sure that they properly diversified their retirement savings, that they weren't unnecessarily exposed to unnecessary risk. They had to find out which part of the money was going to be there safe, no matter what money had to be there. In addition to that, people's home equity, if you got equity in your house right now, a lot of people's values of the properties might be an opportunity for you to have a strategic cash and maybe reposition, refinance some of that equity out, protect some of it, because you don't want your equity trapped inside that property. Next, you know, same thing happened in 08, 09. A lot of people lost it if they didn't cash out, refinance it, or secure it with some form of line of credit or something like that.
That's when we first started hearing, I'm upside down on my mortgage. That was really painful for a lot of Americans, particularly in Nevada and in Florida. I mean, these were places that just got hammered. Okay, so Catherine, let's go over a bit of a checklist for our viewers, because there literally is a checklist we're going to give you tonight for things that you should start doing. Start with the top one, an emergency savings fund. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, we know most Americans are woefully undersaved for an emergency. Most of us don't even have $1,000 saved, but I cannot stress enough the importance of just putting whatever you can aside every month, even if that's just $5, towards a rainy day. It's the classic rainy day fund. If you lose your job, you've got to make sure those fixed expenses that you have every month, food, housing, medical care, are paid for.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it, but 56% of Americans cannot handle an emergency expense of $1,000 or more, even if it's medical or if it's a rate increase on a credit card. Like, that's a tight spot to be in. So that's a tough thing to do, to start an emergency savings fund. But as Catherine just said, start no matter how much. Okay, so Matt, take the next one. Eliminate debt. Sounds like a no-brainer, but talk to me about it.
Two forms of debt, good debt and bad debt. And debt that is bad is something you got to eliminate right away, because that's the type of debt that's most likely the highest in terms of interest rates and things that you cannot deduct on your typical tax return if you're an employee. But the flip side is, if you're a small business owner, you have a business, do good debt, business interest, business expenses. Those are some of the things that you can deduct from your taxes. So if you're going to go through your finances, find out which one of your liabilities can be paid off sooner and faster. Therefore, you don't have to leverage or add more problems to the existing liabilities that you have right now on the balance sheet.
Okay, Catherine, the next one is look at your lifestyle. That sounds obvious, but people might be saying, oh, come on, end of next year, I don't need to stop going to the movies just yet, do I?
Ashley, I'm so glad you brought this one up, because during the pandemic, we all changed our lifestyle so much more than we realized, right? We started maybe getting an extra streaming service. Maybe we have Netflix, and maybe we have Apple TV, and maybe we have all of them because we want to catch our favorite shows. You're going to have to cut back. That's a very, very smart move. And we also know that during the pandemic, people were eating out less. But maybe this meant you started springing for the really fancy olive oil at the grocery store, right? It's time to cut back. It's time to cut back. It's time to go back to the way our habits were pre-pandemic. Especially if you were a good saver, you know what to do.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, Matt, Time for an audit of what we do for a living. We've listed it as a career assessment, but what does that really mean?
You know, we're in the middle of the great reset, the great resignation. The reset, if anything, the pandemic has caused us to rethink our priorities, how we make money, where we want to spend our time. There's some notable companies right now during the middle of tough times. And I'm thinking about companies like Microsoft, DoorDash, Uber, Airbnb, PHP, agency, so many, Hewlett Packard. There's some companies that started their business in the middle of tough times during the recession. Today, multi-billion dollar companies. So career assessment, business opportunity, perhaps. Maybe this is an opportunity for you to bet on yourself.
Okay, Catherine, the last one on the checklist, and it's certainly not the most exhaustive checklist. It's kind of just the emergency checklist. But this one is move around your investments, start reallocating. Give me a little bit more detail on what we should be looking at. I mean, should I be taking cash out, putting it under the mattress, or buying gold or real estate? Or what does it mean to move your investments around?
Yeah, so all this hinges on your age and your timeline to retirement. So if you don't have a financial advisor and you've been thinking about it, this is a really good time to go get one to figure out, you know, where you are and if you're on track. If you are headed towards retirement, again, like I said, having that cash on hand that can float you with your fixed expenses is a really good idea. The bond market is a place that you might want to be if you just don't have the risk tolerance right now to ride out the market. And reshifting things. As we said, COVID changed everything. So maybe you invested in stocks that you knew might perform well. Maybe you put all your money into Zoom. Well, you know what? It's time to rethink that. It's time to take a look at where everything stands and where they're headed in the future, and just really reassess what your priorities are.
But I think what you just said is key. Talk to someone, someone who knows more about you, your risk tolerance, your age, your needs, because it's different for all of us, right? Even on this screen, the three of us will have a different asset allocation in our 401k because of so many factors, kids, planned kids, all the rest. Okay, so Matt, that all the stuff we just listed out, that's a really good prep list for a recession, but it's also just really good financial hygiene at all times. So don't throw out the list, everybody, if it, you know, the recession doesn't come. Keep it and practice that good hygiene. But I want to ask you this, Matt. Sometimes if you watch the financial channels, they get very excited and it kind of scares us viewers. So is this a sky is falling moment or is this really true? Because it seems like there are differing messages out there, although I do think Deutsche Bank is a pretty strong voice.
I think the prudent way to go about your finances is always to be optimistic, but also make sure you watch your back. You have some form of defense. You're always looking for things that just in case, I mean, you have to find out people, as Catherine had mentioned, you got to find out ways to have the right conversation with people that have been there, done that, surround yourself with wise counselors. You are understanding that many people are talking in the media, people talking in news channels that have their opinion too as well. And take that in, learn, assess, find out what works for you, educate yourself. This is financial literacy month. This is April. This is a perfect time for you to go about asking people about what they learned throughout the recession, what they can add to themselves here, because this is also not only the time of protecting yourself, but I believe that no matter what president is going on in the White House, no matter what economic times we are, there's always opportunity to be somebody to champion ahead. This is the moment where a lot of people, the seeds of greatness, the seeds of future multimillionaires and decamillionaires and billionaires are being planted at this very moment.
Yeah, well, listen, no matter what, it's worthy to get a little help early on and to get a jump on things, because I think we were all kind of stunned in 2020. We were stunned in 2008. A lot of us lost a ton of money in housing. We just thought our houses were going to be our investment, the safest investment for life. And then shazam, it wasn't. So great stuff. And thank you, both of you, Matt Cipolla and Catherine Tuggle. I think I'm going to have you back a whole bunch as we sort of creep towards this financial ugliness. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
I want to turn now to an economic crisis in the most unlikely of places, actually, Walt Disney World. Yes, happiest place on earth. Specifically, though, it's the area that surrounds the theme park, you know, just outside the happy place. Just a few miles from the main gates of Disney World is a strip of beaten down motels in Kissimmee, Florida. It is not tourists on a budget that are staying there. It's Disney employees, and they're living there. The average salary of an employee at Walt Disney Parks and Resorts is $38,000. That works out to about $18 an hour. And if you're in Florida, you're going to say, hold it, Ashley, $18 an hour. That is significantly higher than Florida's $10 an hour minimum wage. You're right. It is. It's almost double. But it turns out it is still not nearly enough to afford rent around one of America's top tourist destinations. Hence, motel for the whole family. Like, not staying, like moving in, like living there. You two kids get that bed, mom and dad get the other. News Nation's Brian Enten has spent this week visiting some of these workers who are staying at all these hotels that you're seeing on your screen. It's not just one. It's like a whole swath of them. The story repeats over and over in each one of these hotels. Now, here's what's strange. I'm not sure if it's because of Brian Enten's incredible reporting and his digging, or maybe it's a combination of things. But weirdly, as we were planning to put this story on the air today, Disney, totally unexpectedly, announced a plan to help their struggling employees improve their living conditions.
For more than 50 years, Walt Disney World has played a vital role in Central Florida and has worked closely with other leaders in the area as our community has grown. This place means so much to us, and we're always looking for innovative ways to strengthen this community and to make a difference in the lives of our cast members and our neighbors. Today, we're excited to share some news about a new initiative designed to address a growing challenge in our country and our region, and that's affordable housing. We've looked carefully at the ways we can make a real difference and decided to earmark nearly 80 acres of our land to create affordable housing development right here in Central Florida.
Well, I just feel better with that music. Okay, now let's get back to the gut check. Is this going to really solve the problem, or is this a Band-Aid solution? I want to talk to you about this, Brian, because this is something else. And by the way, congratulations. You got a promotion. You're now News Nation's senior national correspondent. So that's nice to know. You deserve that. Let's get right to it. Living at Disney World means living in motels for a lot of these people. And I'm going to talk more about the development part, the Disney part, what they just announced. But first, I don't know that a lot of Americans know this about all those cast members who are so happy that they're stuck in these motel rooms living there permanently. I mean, it came to a shock to me. Is it a shock to people in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, it is eye-opening. I grew up down here going to Disney, which is right behind me, the resort, going to the theme parks, thinking it was so perfect. Everything is so perfectly manicured, and all those cast members are smiling, and they seem like they have the greatest life. But if you go just a couple of miles from here to Kissimmee, Florida, there is a strip of motels. I'm not talking 5 or 10 motels. I'm talking 30 or 40 motels where many of these theme park workers now live. Not just husband and wife, but there are families. If you go early in the morning, the school bus shows up and all the little kids come out of the motel rooms and get on the school bus, and their parents work at Disney and they cannot afford an apartment or a house or anywhere that is remotely okay for them to live in. We met one family. It's a mom, dad. The dad is a Disney bus driver making $18 an hour. They have two kids living in the motel room. They have three dogs and a cat because they moved out of the house. And then they are taking care of an elderly loved one all in one motel room. Take a look. She showed me what it was like in there.
Up there, I have a little oven that I can cook
God,
in.
Oh, my God, it's elderly.
In our microwave. This was our fridge from back home that we brought with us.
The rooms don't come equipped with the fridges. They come with the little miniature fridges. And a lot of people, that's all they have here.
So they've got their refrigerator in there, Ashley, from their old house, because they've got so many people living in the motel room, they have to stock it up with food.
It's astounding to think a family of four is living in that little tiny space. And I suppose the only sink would be the bathroom sink. So that's also the kitchen sink and any source of drinking water as well. So I also noticed, Brian, they have Disney decor all over the place. Like, they've decorated their motel room with a lot of Disney paraphernalia. So, they seem to really love their employer. And I would only assume that the announcement today was really welcome news. How did they take the news that there's going to be some fix coming?
Well, first of all, that family and many of the families are obsessed with Disney. They move from all over the country here to work for Disney because they think it's going to be this dream, and then they realize they can't live in Central Florida. In terms of how they received the news, I mean, look, they're living in motel rooms. At this point, it is a plan. It is a rendering. It is a drawing. Yes, they're saying they're going to do this on 80 acres, but imagine how long it's going to take to build, and you've got countless families living in the motels. So they're optimistic about the future, but it's not going to solve any problems in the short term.
So then I know you talked to some people about the fact that they're making more than minimum wage, but less than what most people consider a living wage. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so Disney pays $15 an hour at a minimum. So a lot of the theme park workers make $15 an hour, which is significantly higher than the Florida minimum wage. But Florida is on fire right now. Ever since the pandemic, people have moved here from all over the country and gobbled up all the houses. There's basically nowhere to buy. And if you want to rent a place, well, guess what? The rents have gone up $1,000 or $2,000. So $15 an hour is not what it used to be a couple of years ago. Listen to what one woman told me. Is there any way for you to get ahead, to get a normal place?
No, there's no way. I mean, all the prices, the gas prices, everything is going up. And our paychecks are not showing it, you know.
And she didn't want to show her face, Ashley. You can imagine a lot of these people are nervous because they work for Disney or for the other theme parks.
Well, I can understand that. So, look, I was trying to think about how many people work there, and then the, was it 80 acres? I'm trying to remember this, the plot of land they're earmarking. So there's 77,000 employees who work at Disney. And then that pretty picture showed the development. But is there going to be enough housing for all the people who really need it is the short question.
Yeah, it's 1,300 units, Ashley, 80 acres, 1,300 units. The renderings look beautiful, but they're also saying that it won't just be Disney workers that are allowed to apply and live there. So there are all sorts of other people who don't have anywhere to live in this community who could also apply. So I think it's just going to help a very little bit when you look at how massive the problem is.
Oh, I mean, yeah, 1,300 units, there's 77,000 workers. So I can imagine that, you know, there's more than 1,300 people in those, you know, rows and rows of motels. Okay, so I looked at some of the financials of Disney, and the company's worth about $97 billion with a B. Just last year alone, it earned $67 billion. It's a lot of money. It's totally allowed, you know, in this country, you can make it big. And that's what we, you know, that's what we hang our hat on. But are they going to pass the cost to us? Whatever it costs to look after these employees, does that mean ticket prices or Cokes or Mickey posters or any of the other stuff or the rides? Is that going to cost more?
I don't think so. I mean, gosh, can you know what it costs to like even buy like a little popcorn at Disney? It could be like
it's $10
crazy. Or $15 or more if you want the specialty bucket. So I can't imagine they're going to raise the prices that much more. I think they're realizing like we've got a really big problem. I mean, our workers who put on the little Disney cast member badge and look so amazing at work and put on this beautiful face, like some of them are even sleeping in cars. And I think it's hit them, we've got to do something. So good for them on that, but it's not helping in the short term. Just go out to Kissimmee, go to any motel, you'll meet the families right away.
So I know that a lot of them have been frustrated by the tax breaks that Florida gives to Disney. I get it. If you're a major employer and you're stimulating the economy in Florida and you're bringing people from all over the nation, all over the world to dump their popcorn money into your state, you get tax breaks. But I think a lot of the people who are struggling to live are frustrated by that.
Yeah, and look, I mean, you're right. Bottom line, Disney is the biggest employer anywhere in this area. It's huge for Florida. It brings people from all over. But you've got a lot of people saying, hold on a minute, they get some really special privileges. I mean, did you know that on Disney property, 25,000 acres, they basically get to have their own little form of government? where they appoint a board of directors that oversee the area. They control the roads, they control the fire, they even have their own electric plant. They even control permitting. If they want to build something, they permit it themselves, which has a lot of people also saying, okay, you get to permit it yourself, you can get this affordable housing up in months, not years.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, this is a great story. I'm glad that you brought it to us, because I have to say, I have made those trips with two kids and, you know, taken out a mortgage to do it, and never thought once that those happy employees weren't thoroughly happy in their lives off the property. So thank you for shining a light on that, Brian. I really appreciate it. Pop the popcorn, pick out something green to wear, because the one and only Tiger Woods is set to tee off at the Masters at 10:30 tomorrow morning. Despite nearly losing his leg last year in an almost fatal car crash, I might add, it is simply an amazing story at Augusta National. And it is almost as amazing as the Thacker House, a three-bedroom brick house built in 1959 and just a par five from the second tee box at Augusta. Herman and Elizabeth Thacker live there, and they've been there for 63 years. They raised their kids there, their grandkids, and their great-grandkids, too. And when Augusta started buying up all the homes around them to make way for free parking, they said no thanks to the generous offer from the golf club. And every year that offer just gets more generous. Even though their house is worth roughly $330,000 on Zillow, Augusta still floats a $1 million offer their way on a regular basis. The Thackers told reporters recently, and I'll quote them, "We really don't want to go. Money ain't everything. Here, every so often, they come and they say, we just want to let you know we're still interested in your property," and we tell them the same thing again. So that's that. Augusta has spent nearly $200 million buying up all the property around their storied golf course, much of it to go to that free parking for the Masters fans. Even Herman Thacker's own brother sold his home to the golf club and two other properties too, and raked in $3.6 million doing it. But for Herman, the memories are more valuable than the offer. After all, he used to walk the 600 yards to the course with his sweet little grandson, Scott, and watch the players make their rounds. And that little boy, Scott, grew up to be Scott Brown, who is a professional golfer currently playing on the PGA Tour. Scott has yet to qualify for the Masters, but let's just say it. If and when he does, he's got a pretty sweet little convenient spot to stay. And maybe that's the reason the Thackers refuse to sell. But I love them for it. All right, I'm going to do a quick turn here. Still ahead tonight, if Vladimir Putin is so insulated that he doesn't feel the pinch of all those sanctions that everyone's been levying against him, maybe his daughters will. After the break, Joe Biden takes aim at Putin's precious little girls and all the wealth and assets that they've been enjoying for decades. And spoiler alert, they are no longer free to roam about the planet. Welcome back. It is hard to picture Vladimir Putin as a family man, but he's not only a father, he is a grandfather. Just watch him try not to gush when Oliver Stone asks him about his grandkids in this next little thing I'm going to show you. It's a Showtime series clip from 2017. And I'm kidding, of course. There is no gushing here. Putin seems barely human.
The two daughters are married and they bring their husbands. So you meet your son-in-laws on the weekend?
So
are you a grandfather yet?
Yeah.
How do you like your grandchildren?
Yes.
So are you a good grandfather? Do you play with them in the garden?
Very seldom.
Very seldom.
Well, I've seen more emotion from a cyborg. The two daughters that Putin mentioned are Katerina Tikhonova and Maria Putina. And today, they found out that buying Chanel in Paris and having dinner in Rome or London is now officially off the to-do list. They just got sanctioned. They joined most of Russia's wealthiest people and their dad himself on Biden's list. News Nation correspondent Tom Negevin joins me now live with that. You know, Tom, there was a time when politicians' kids were off limits, but those two girls do not flit about the globe as daughters, do they?
And you know, I feel like we've picked up right where we left off last night, Ashley. It's just so, I mean, surreal is a trite and overused expression, but it truly is. You know, it's so interesting. Sanctions against Putin's daughters that likely will have very little economic impact, at least in the near term on the Putin family. I mean, let's be honest about that. Probably a much greater impact, the sanctions on the Russian economy writ large, and unfortunately on the Russian people, the poorest among them. But the message this sends, of course, designed to be very personal. That is the daughter of Russian President Vladimir Putin, Katerina Tikhonova, on the screen, taking part in an economic forum in St. Petersburg last year. We don't know much about her, but she's believed to work in artificial intelligence. We know even less about her older sister, Maria Vorontsova, a 36-year-old who works in medical research. Their father spoke about them just briefly at a press conference 6 years ago. My daughters live in Russia and studied only in Russia. I'm proud of them, Vladimir Putin said. I never discuss my family with anyone. Well, the world is discussing his family now after the horrors being uncovered in suburban Kyiv in the wake of Russia's invasion. Both daughters facing sanctions now from the U.S. and EU. The White House saying these individuals have enriched themselves at the expense of the Russian people. Some of them are responsible for providing the support necessary to underpin Putin's war on Ukraine. Included in that assessment, the families of other top Russian officials, like Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And tonight, there are full blocking sanctions against Russia's biggest state and private banks, which means any assets touching the U.S. financial system will be frozen. As the U.S. and its allies continue to target the assets of Russia's elite, this super yacht may be next, owned by sanctioned oligarch Roman Abramovich. It's been on the move near Montenegro. Economic analysts say this is about hitting Russia's elite where they live. After the horrific war crimes revealed by retreating Russian troops, President Biden today.
And together with our allies and our partners, we're going to keep raising the economic cost and ratchet up the pain for Putin and further increase Russia's economic isolation.
Economic isolation, Ashley, but tonight some serious concern among economists and politics watchers globally about the ability of these sanctions to do that. The Russian ruble, as you know, crashed weeks ago when the first round of sanctions were let loose, recovering then as the EU bought Russian oil and gas, which is helping to offset Moscow's cost of the war in Ukraine, Ashley.
Yeah, it gets tiresome, though, if the only place you can go is North Korea or Iran, if you're the age of those young ladies. And I know that Putin's family has a penchant for London. So I guess the question I have, and I don't know if anybody can answer it, Tom, do these daughters have the same kind of influence over their dad that most daughters do? Or are they kidsy kind of acknowledges?
You cannot imagine that they possibly would in this world. I'm so glad that you ran that Oliver Stone clip earlier, because I mean that is as revealing as anything we've seen or heard from Vladimir Putin, and certainly more than anything we've ever heard from the Kremlin about these two young ladies, which won't even identify them by their last name. We know or we believe they're very well educated, both of them very accomplished, very successful in their own right, but influence over their father, that is something that most observers would agree no one truly has. Vladimir Putin, an absolute loose cannon, we suspect even to them.
He should be worried about them, and he probably did himself and them a very big favor by keeping them as quiet as possible with their profiles. Tom Nagevin in New York, thank you so much for that. Appreciate it.
You bet.
When we come back, the horrors of war as only a warrior can know them and inflict them.
It feels good that I just blew shit up. I hope to blow this whole country up. Not gonna lie.
Inside the minds of men and women recruited, trained, and required to kill anyone who gets in their way. That's after the break. There is word from the Pentagon tonight that Russian forces have completely pulled out from the areas around the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv and the pulverized northern city of Chernihiv. Those soldiers, and believe it when I say it, as many as 40,000 Russian soldiers are said to be regrouping and rearming in Russia and Belarus and likely will return to the fight. Eventually, it's thought in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region, which you can see over there in the far right of your screen. Officials there are right now telling the civilians who live there, get out. Get out while you can. Please let's not see a repeat of what we've seen in the other. I mean, look at these pictures. And on the ground, it is so much worse. In the Russian troops' wake, the world has seen gut-wrenching scenes of death and devastation aimed largely at innocent people. This is what's left of Borodyanka, a town of 13,000 before the war. And more recently, it was a staging ground for Russian troops moving in on Kyiv. Well, now those troops have moved out, but too late to save Borodyanka. The city of Bucha, also on Kyiv's outskirts, is literally strewn with body bags and bodies awaiting bags. But this is war, and the killing goes both ways. Fair warning, these are sanitized images from a video clip that was posted this week, apparently showing Ukrainian soldiers killing Russian soldiers who were already captured and wounded. And if you wonder what it takes to pull a trigger or fire a missile and take the life of someone who may or may not pose a threat, be glad that you never had to.
We actually had a board in our COC. You know, we kept a kill count.
We made a decision that not only are we going to shoot first, but we're going to do so without fear of repercussion. That's how the military's built. You obey orders.
That is from a sobering new docuseries produced for the streaming platform Vet TV. It's called Let's Talk About War. And the war in this case was Afghanistan. Nick Betts is the producer and director, and he's also a former Army sniper. Waco Hoover is the CEO of Vet TV and a former Marine. Welcome to the both of you. Nick, I'll start with you. When you see some of the images that we've been seeing, especially this week, coming out of Afghanistan, do you guys see things differently than say, I do? Do vets have a whole different paradigm through which they look at those kinds of images?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, those feelings are inevitable. And after, you know, 20 years of combat and, you know, losing, you know, that conflict and now seeing somebody else go through the same tragedies that we had to go through, it's gut-wrenching knowing that this is just incredibly unprovoked and unwarranted. It's pretty sad watching this.
Waco, I want to play one of the clips from your production, and I think it really just speaks to the visceral nature of the work. And let's be frank, it's a job. It's the work, you know, that you're doing when you're in theater, as we call it, but in the war zone itself. Take a look at this.
I may feel this in my soul one day, but I don't give a f- because all that matters is coming home alive.
So, Waco, tell me about that. All that matters is coming home alive. That has to inform a lot of action from any soldier, no matter what side, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, when you're speaking about the Ukrainian conflict earlier, you know, there's two sides of that. Obviously, you know, Russia initiated that. But when we're looking at the docuseries that we put together, you know, we really wanted to shine a spotlight on what it does to the warrior. I think in America, we celebrate, you know, our soldiers when they come home, but there is a huge amount of work that still needs to be done to really support them because of the experiences that we see when you're downrange. And people just can't fathom, you know, what that's like to go through it and then what that transition is like going back to the civilian world.
I mean, you're a completely different person. How could you not be? You can't unsee, you can't unhear, you can't unthink the things that you've been through, and they're wholly unnatural. I mean, they just are. So I want to ask about, you know, looking at this war, comparing it to the war that you know so personally, Vladimir Putin doesn't seem to care. That's a big difference between America and, say, Russia and their militaries. He doesn't, they're collateral, right? They're expendable. The soldiers, they weren't even told the truth. And that's not to say that our country hasn't had that same folly, but do you sometimes wonder about these Russian soldiers? And it's hard to feel for them given what we're seeing left behind in their wake. But at the same time, many of them had reported being starved and freezing and being, you know, led into a slaughter they knew nothing about. They thought they were in training.
It's a really difficult situation when you think about it from both sides. You know, it's warfare. It's ugly and it's disgusting. And it's nasty, and that's the nature of it. And when you look at, you know, like you said, the Russians who, you know, were misled about what they were going into, you have to feel for some of them. But at the same time, for the Ukrainians, they're protecting their country. They're fighting for their families, for their lives. It would be no different than us fighting for our home here in America if a similar situation were to happen. And so, it's a really dark thing to look at. But the only way to get through it is to, you know, you're going to take care of your family and your friends and your country.
It's amazing work, and I recommend our viewers take a look at Vet TV. It's, I mean, we need to understand before we can pass any judgment or assume that we know or make good foreign policy as well. So Nick Betts, Waco Hoover, thank you. Thank you for your work, and thank you for doing this tonight, and also thank you so much for serving your country for us. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you to you both. I'm so glad that you are home. You made it home. Coming up after the break, when the term World War III shows up in news headlines, it has a tendency to make countries take a good long look at their defense readiness. So just how ready are we here in the U.S.? Just how big is the U.S. military, especially compared to others? Take a guess, and remember, it includes Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and the newly minted Space Force. The answer's next. Before the break, I asked you how big is the U.S. military, and the answer is 1.4 million big. That's active duty military members, according to World Population Review. That cites U.S. Census data, and that places us in third in total active duty personnel. First is China with 2.3 million. Second is India with 1.5 million. But, let me just say this. Marnie Hughes and Leland Vittert, as you take the helm, don't feel bad. Because we actually do pretty well when it comes to spending.
Oh, yeah? How much?
$601 billion we spend on defense. And if you're comparing that to the number one folks, the Chinese, it's roughly three times the spending of the Chinese. So maybe that'll make people sleep better at night. I don't know.
Makes a big difference. All right, Ashley, great show tonight. Thank you.